Hi, guys, and welcome to Cycles News and Views. It is March the 9th, and I have with me Peter the Great, Peter Elides. Peter, welcome. Been a long time.
Thanks, Tim. Always fun to talk with you about the market, especially.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, Peter. Peter, this has been one heck of a process to watch. I think we would both agree that it's been an ever-expanding bubble. I never imagined it would go as far as it did and last as long as it did. But I also knew that structure was key, and, you know, we never had, or at least in my world, I never had any structure to bite, and it just kept extending and extending and extending. You know, we got close a few times back in September. We were real close to a setup, but then we saw the repo thing, and it, you know, the can got kicked down the road again, as they say. I kind of hate that saying, but it fits. And then coming out of that low, though, they forced, if you will, it was a little early, but it kind of forced a key cycle. And then I began to see how, so like, wait a minute, this could set up with I started anticipating a left translation of that cycle. Then we roll into an extended intermediate term cycle low in January, the bottom of January 31st. And I wrote in my letter, I said, you know, if this sets up with a left translated top, this lesser degree cycle, it's going to be indicative of all these higher degree cycle tops. And that's exactly what happened. And then on February 24th, like magic, it just broke. And that setup was confirmed. We saw Dow Theory primary bearish trend change. And here we are. How does this all fit? What do you see? How does this fit with your work? What does this mean? Where are we?
Well, Tim, I think you and I have agreed over the past couple of years that we were looking at something quite remarkable. And the thing that I will give both of us credit for, as opposed to the great majority of stock analysts out there, is that both of us have a real good sense of market history. And that's so important in analyzing the market. That's the first thing that impressed me about you, Tim, is what I first ran into your work in, I believe it was the magazine Technical Analysis of Stocks and Commodities. And I read the article. I think you had written something on the four-year cycle or something. If we're going back. Do you remember how long ago that article was? It must have been 10 or 15 years ago.
That was in 2000. That was in regards to the 2000 top.
Yeah, there you go. So, and the thing that most impressed me about you was that you went back further than 1995. Because, I mean, I can't tell you how many of these wonder boy market analysts say, you know, they try to give you some kind of pattern or something, and they say, no, I did my research on this. I went back to 1987. You know, it's like, no, guys. We haven't really had a bear market since 1987. The last time the stock market was truly undervalued in terms of the long-term things we look at for undervaluation, whether it be dividend yield, price to book value, things like that, the last time we were undervalued was in 1982. We're talking almost 40 years ago, Tim. And I think you and I had an appreciation for that. I'm not saying we were the only ones, but people that are aware of market history go back and look, and they say, okay, this is what the story was here, and this is where we stood with this indicator or that indicator. And as averse as I am overall to using fundamentals, I guess when you talk about valuation, that's really kind of a combination of valuation of fundamentals and the technical side. So it was quite apparent, though, for a long time how overvalued this market was. And even this morning, Tim, even this morning, as I was watching Fox Financial, they were interviewing a guy that came on, and the newscaster said to him, he said, I guess the good part of all this is we could be looking at a fantastic buying opportunity, right? And the guy on the phone said, not just a fantastic buying opportunity, he said, a generational buying opportunity. So here we are with the first move below the most overvalued market, arguably, in history, and the first move down of 15 or 20% is generational buying opportunity. So that's the sentiment out there, Tim. We have people that have never seen. I mean, there are people in there. Let's put it this way. If 82 is the last time we were undervalued, really undervalued and historically undervalued, and let's say someone was born in 1952, so he, no, not 72, so he was 10 years old, not really knowing the market at that time. So you could have a person that was born around 1970, 72, that is now 50 years old, that has never really seen a bear market or an undervalued, an historical undervalued market.
That's right.
And so here we are looking at a market that has done an incredibly fast decline. So here's what one of the things that interested me historically, Tim, was that I heard somewhere, probably in one of the TV stations in the last week or so, after the first decline off the high, I think we, after 7 days, I believe the S&P cash was down somewhere around 11 or 12%. And someone said that they thought that that was they actually said it categorically that that was the greatest decline from an all-time high in 7 days in history. And I said, well, that's an interesting observation because, you know, as technicians, one of the things we look at, especially at a market bottom, is that kickoff move to the upside where you see fabulous breadth day after day, week after week almost, and all the newbies are saying, oh, my RSI is up at 70, so this market is overbought. We better sell short now. And, of course, all they're looking at is that kickoff move from the upside that initiates a bull market. Well, not too many people have seen that kickoff move to the downside that initiates a bear market. And so the argument can be made that, indeed, that's something that we looked at here over the past couple of weeks and through today. I mean, so people will know, as you and I are speaking, we just lived through a day today where the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 2,013.76 points. I mean, you and I have lived through times when the Dow was priced at 2,013. Never mind lose that much in points in a day. Anyway, I digress because I wanted to talk about that initial decline we have. Now, neither one of us is a great Elliottician. At least I don't claim to be. I don't think you do.
No,
either,
I don't,
Tim.
Either. No, no.
But we're aware of the way it works, and I think overall we both respect the theory. You have usually from a market top, you have a wave down, and then you have a recovery from that initial wave down, and the third move, like one down, two up, three to the downside, is usually the biggest decline of the five-wave pattern to the downside. And the three-wave to the upside, same thing, usually the largest move and the most dynamic one. So we very seldom have seen from new all-time highs significant market declines to begin with. And so when this guy said this on TV, this is the greatest seven-day decline from an all-time high in history, I said, you know what, I'm going to look into that over the next week or two, because thank God we have spreadsheets and Excel to work with them, and things like this you can look up, although it's not the easiest thing in the world if you think about it. What you want to tell the spreadsheet is, hey, go back and look at every time there was a new all-time high followed by a decline, and tell me the most the market went down within the first 7 days of that decline from an intraday all-time high. How the hell do you tell the computer to do that? And so I struggled. It was a couple of days ago over the weekend. I sat down and I said, listen, I know I can do all this stuff. All I got to do is think about it. Well, I thought about it and tried something and thought about it and tried something again. I can't tell you how many formulas I tried trying to encapsulate that whole thing about, hey, first of all, it's got to be an all-time high. Second of all, there's got to be a decline from it. And third of all, you want to know what was the greatest decline within the first 7 days from the all-time high. Well, guess what? I came up with a formula. And now I'll give you the results. February 20th of 2020 was when the decline began. We topped out on the, this is on the S&P cash, on 2/19 of 2020. And the first day of the decline was February 20th, and within the next seven trading days, in fact, seven trading days later, the S&P 500 cash was down 12.76%. That indeed was the greatest decline in history. When I say history, going back almost 100 years to the mid-1920s for the S&P, that was indeed the greatest decline from an all-time high in history. Not only that, it was the only double-digit decline within 7 days from an all-time high in the history of the stock market. Some of the trailing dates beneath that are interesting, and some of them are not. None of them was, I can't point to, I don't think any of them, as I'm looking at them quickly here, and say, see, these were also important highs too. But I'll give you some dates going down in time after that one. So from February 20th of 2020, that decline began, and within 7 days, we were down 12.76% on a closing basis, not intraday. The next largest decline from an all-time high was December 1st of 1928. So you really have to go back almost 100 years again before you had a really large decline. We did have one on September 5th of 1986. We had a 9.1% decline. And then, if you use February 18th of 2020, we also had a decline of 7.8% within the first seven trading days. So these are interesting little pieces of data. The next one again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The next one was Jan 29 of 2018. So within 7 days of that date, we had a 7.8% decline. Then it's 19, I'll just give you the years now, 1928, 1987, 1989, 1980, 89, 1955, 55, 2018 again. So that's the picture, though, and an interesting statistical picture about how this kickoff move to the downside from an all-time high was the largest in the recorded history that I have, certainly the history of the S&P composite. S&P composite, by the way, in the mid-1920s, was not the S&P 500, but it was still the S&P composite, even though it was comprised of a smaller amount of stocks. So that's the kickoff move we had to the downside, Tim. And what you and I have to figure out as analysts now is, was that really a very major top that we saw? Or are we really going to get one of these huge springboard things that brings us down a quick 20-25%, and we see a final crazy market rally to the upside that is completely baseless and without any confirming technical tidbits at all? I don't think that's going to happen. I'd be interested in your opinion on that, but I can't completely rule it out. I mean, did we have a divergence in the AD line on the February 19th high? Indeed we did, but it was the tiniest of divergences on the S&P. I mean, from, I think the daily AD line had topped out about a week before, and only by, it wasn't by too many advanced decline units that the divergence was there. But there was a small divergence on February 19th at that all-time high on the S&P. So if we didn't have a big divergence there, does that mean that down the road somewhere this year? See, I believe that if this was not a really important high that we saw, that we're still going to see a really important high this year. I don't think we're going to hang around for another couple of years, down and up and down and up. So that's my initial instinct now in terms of what I saw. How do you feel about that one, Tim?
Well, let me add a couple of things as a lead into that. But number one, looking at, you're talking about the history of the market, and you know that's one thing that, how I'm trying to choose my words, that's one thing that has, and I guess you would say, just blurted out here, that has made us wrong about the extent of this is because of that historical perspective. And what I mean
that's
is...
Right. We know too much about market history.
Exactly, because this has violated... I mean, look at my, you know, myself, you, and poor Hussman, and anybody that knows anything about, you know, any statistical-based discipline that goes back any length of time, you know, they've been wrong. And so what that proves is not that we're a bunch of buffoons, but what it proves is the... how extreme this advance has been. I mean that's the reality of it. So, you know, the people who have a shorter time span who only looked at history since 1982, then, you know, they look like geniuses. But you go back and you get a truly historical perspective on this, and it's been one heck of an abnormality. That said, you know, I can't rule out. I know there's a couple of people. You know, I don't know where Bob stands on this. At one point, he was looking for another high with his Elliott Wave work. There's another guy, a friend in Belgium, who was looking for another high based on the discipline that he has that I respect. I don't know where Bob is on it now, but you know, he was looking for another high. Anyway, that said, the structure broke. Things changed throughout this entire process. You know, I've harped. You know, it's a bubble. It's a bubble. It's a bubble. It's a bubble. But at the same time, we never had structure, and now we do. And we had the Dow 30 primary bearish trend change to boot. Everything fell in place, like I said, on February 24th. And so to see all of a sudden, we get structure, we move into some kind of low, and then we rally to a new high. It seems improbable. One thing I've learned is never say never. So as we move in, there are some cycle lows ahead of us. Once we move into those lows, we'll have to, you know, kind of feel my way along there and see if we see something trying to develop. But at this point, it looks to me like, well, it doesn't look, the structure is broken. And I think that we've seen a major four-year cycle top, and it's hard to believe. Also, one of the things I've done in trying to understand this is I've gone back in the last three or four letters and looked at some of the underlying fundamental data, if you will, that was kind of boring, but then as I got into it, it was kind of exciting too, because it helped me to understand, fit the pieces together. And I did that, you know, for myself and for subscribers to try to really understand the environment that we were in. And one thing I would arguably, argument I would make is that this has been, the post-2009 period has been the weakest economic recovery since the Great Depression. And you can see that in the economic data. Another thing that was key that I saw come together was understanding, and I'm only beginning to understand because it's terribly complicated, and I had someone really helping me understand this and feeding me the material, but understanding the yield curve. And, you know, there was the inversion of the yield curve. Then you go through this portion that's called this middle portion, which started in really August and went through to January. And as soon as it broke, the market set up with structure, and here we are. So understanding the underlying economic conditions, understanding that yield curve structure and what has happened, and now the structure of the market itself, it seems very unlikely that we would see a move like that and you know, to a new high from here.
So explain to people what you mean by saying the structure broke, Tim.
Well, I have, you know, in my work you have a long-term cycle, and then within cycles you have cycles. And if the structure is positive, then pick a midpoint. You know, like an isosceles triangle, you go up. It's kind of like going up the steps versus going down the steps. If you, any cycle of a given degree, if the trend of the next higher degree is rising, then the structure of that cycle is right translated. In other words, it goes up beyond its midpoint, and then by default, it holds above its previous low, and it just keeps stair-stepping up.
When so, in other words, let's say, for example, there's a 40-week cycle. If things are balanced in terms of underlying trend, and let's say it's neutral, that cycle would be up for 20 weeks and down for 20 weeks.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
But
if things are positive, then it will go up longer than it would come down.
Exactly.
That's basically what you're saying.
And that's what we've seen. Every time the market would try to bite, it'd get right on the edge of a left translated cycle of whatever degree, and then we would see a tweet. We would see a trade deal. We would see a repo agreement. We would see something, and it just kept blowing the bubble.
When you say that left translated cycle, that would be an example where the 40-week cycle would go up for only 9 instead of 20 weeks, start to come down, you think, well, wait a minute, boy, we might have a left translation here. And then all of a sudden, nope, I guess we don't. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. But what I'm saying, exactly. It would never bite. It would mend itself, and it would do it around the news. It was always very timely. But what happened coming out of the August low, it was kind of forced. There's a cycle of about a year in duration, and it forced that low to have come in August. And so then I started to see with this other stuff, with understanding or beginning to understand, I say, the yield curve and this other underlying economic stuff, and I started to say, wait a minute, this is likely to set up with a left-translated cycle of that degree, this annual cycle, set up with a left translation. And so we pushed up into January, and then we had an intermediate degree low. Then it set up with a left translated cycle, which confirmed that top. And then bada bing, bada boom, I mean in a matter of days, all of a sudden it set up and we were there. And that's why I'm saying we've rounded that corner, the structure broke. And then in addition to the structure, we have all these other underlying things that support that. And so one thing I've learned is never underestimate the extent the Fed will go to. But it's going to be extremely difficult to fix the structure now because it's broken.
Yep.
And that's something we haven't had here. And so that from that perspective, things have changed.
Interesting.
So I don't know, Peter, looking at the four-year cycle, it bottomed in my world, every indication it bottomed in December 2018, it's peaked, and it's 34 months, giving the norm. It's 34 months before we move into the next four-year cycle low, assuming it's a normal duration, and it's left translated. So that said, that sets us up for a long ways down if this indeed can't be fixed. That said, how does that fit possibly with what you see, projections you have, and where you think we could go?
Well, it's interesting that I have looked at a couple of patterns, two or three patterns, over the last, some of them go back further than others, but what I just wrote about in my two most recent reports that I do online, I hesitate to call them newsletters anymore because we don't really do a newsletter type thing, we just do reports that we publish online. But in the last two reports, Tim, as you know, I wrote about some longer, one of them is a longer term pattern, the other one's a very long term pattern. The one that might be the most interesting now in terms of this could be a really, really long term negative picture is one that I wrote about. I discovered it by accident. I mean, it's the perfect definition of serendipity. I was working on something and I ended up looking at something else and saying, my goodness, wait a minute, let me look at this chart. So there's a chart, a monthly chart, that I used the foundation from the study of cycles data that goes back to 1789 on the markets. And it's not easy to work with in Excel because Excel thinks that the world began in 1900. So when you try to do dates prior to 1900 in Excel, they give you a hard time. So I ended up working out a way to do a chart that went back to 1789, a monthly one, but I used numbers and for the x-axis rather than specific dates, and then on the top I put dates in. But I had a monthly chart that went from 1789 into right around the current time period. And I published it because there was a pattern that was not my discovery, but it was a discovery from a subscriber of mine about, I don't even remember the exact length of them now. I think it was like 33 years or 32 years and 6 months from important market bottoms. There tend to be important market tops. And that's there's another one of those that's due in this time span. If you go back to 1987, 87, 97, 07, 17, and two more, 19, and then you add on the months from the October of 87, you're coming into the same time zone where we could see an important top. But those are tops, even a 33-year one, that could only last maybe for a year or two or three, typically, as we see in bull markets if they continue on. You know, every year or two, even if you have a bear market, a few years later, you go up to a new all-time highs and you're in a bull market again. We want to think and we want to look at the possibility that we may not see prices like this for a long, long time, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Is that possible? Well, I mean, you go back to 1929 and you didn't approach the 29 high again till a quarter century later, Tim. So is something like that possible again? Of course it is. We're not saying it's going to happen, but just based on history, things like that have happened before. So, again, I digress a little bit because I'm looking at this chart that's in front of me now, and this is what I looked at, and I was using it to show that 32, 33-year pattern from bottom to important top. And I looked at it and I said, well, look at this. This is interesting. There are like two really large declines on this chart. And that's all there were. I mean, there were plenty of declines, but not ones that stood out as being the really large ones. And the first one bottomed a few years before 1845. It was like in the late 1830s, early 1840s. That was an important market bottom. I think it might have been 1842. But I don't have the exact date in front of me because, as I said, Excel has trouble with pre-1900 dates. But there was a big bottom at that time, and then we had a rally. If you look at the chart long-term and forget all the little dips and ups and downs, there was a rally that increased dramatically to its final top, which happened to be in 1929. And then I looked at the decline from 29 to 32. That was the second really large decline on the chart. And I said, that's interesting. There are only two really large declines. The first one, which ended in early 1840s, was a 76% decline. We haven't seen anything like that. Well, I shouldn't say that. I guess the NASDAQ suffered around an 80% decline from the 2000 high. But the broad general market, the overall capitalization indexes, S&P, Dow Jones Industrial, and whatever, the averages were going all the way back to 1789. They had not suffered that kind of decline, 75 to 80 to 90%. So the only ones on the chart were the one that ended in 1842-ish and 1932. And so I said, well, I wonder how long that pattern was from that bottom around 1840-whatever to the top in 1929, and it turned out to be 87 years and 6 months. So I said, 87 years and 6 months, that looks like it's really similar to the current pattern from the 1932 bottom. And so I said, well, rather than seeing what it looks like, let's figure out the months. Let's figure them out exactly. So indeed, I calculated it was 87 and a half years, 87 years, 6 months from that 1840-ish low to that 1929 high. And then I said, what if we added that exact same number of years and months to the low in July of 32? And lo and behold, I did that. And the answer came up with January of 2020, Tim.
Wow.
And I said, oh my goodness, isn't that interesting? Now, you can't make too much out of it because it's not like it's a pattern that's repeated 5 or 10 times in the past. But it just fascinated me that previous 1929, I think everyone acknowledged, with a possible exception of the NASDAQ in 2000, most people would acknowledge, most true market historians would acknowledge, that that 29 top was probably one of the most important and most speculative tops in market history. And so where that led to and how long it took to get up to it from the previous very important bottom was a question of a long period of time. It took 87 and a half years, and maybe that's what we just saw now. From July of 32, we went through all these little cycles. They didn't feel little at the time. That 1974 decline didn't feel little. The 87 crash didn't feel little. But as I sit back and look at this chart, I see, well, there's a huge decline in the 32, and since then, the market's been up, 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 with little bumps and bellies along the way. But finally, here we are in 2020. Is this going to be anything like the 29 high, which lasted for 25 years? And nobody knows. We don't know how long. If it was an important high, we don't even know that. I think I would be willing to wager more than a dollar or two that it might turn out to be an important high, but I certainly wouldn't wager anything that's very important to me in life that it's going to be a final high for the next 5, 10, 15 years. The bottom line is, though, that that possibility remains very real, Tim, that we just witnessed one of the more important tops in history. Now, what we can talk about for a minute or two is guys that will come up to me and you and say, you know, you guys are so full of malarkey, talking about technicals and cycles and important market tops. You have to know that the only reason this market is down is because of the coronavirus. It doesn't have anything to do with cycles or any of the stuff you guys look at. It's just the coronavirus, that's all. It could be have a major impact on the economy, on the world economy, and the market's reacting to that. So how should we answer those people, Tim?
You know, the older I get, the less I want to deal with someone who doesn't have a foundation to understand, and I would just, you're right, and I probably wouldn't even argue with them face to face. Just look at them as an idiot and walk off. But, you know, there's always that cover story. There's always that reason they point to. And you and I both know that the technicals, it goes back to the structure. The structure has to be there, and I don't mean to beat that dead horse, but a perfect example. Remember, I mean, I could make there's a number of calls, you know, going back to, in my career, going back to the 2000 top, you know, I made the call saying we were, in 2000 we were going to go below the 98 low. Well, that was crazy, but it did it, and I don't remember what all the reasons were, but the technical reason was is that the cycle, the structure was set up. In 2007, you know, I said that, yes, this cycle's extended, but we're going below the 2002 low. Why? Because the structure suggested that we were, the statistics suggested that we were, and we did. The oil top in commodity top in 2008, people were screaming peak oil, and I said, nope, we're going down. And called it on Jim Pupava's show a week after the top. And I was right about that. And I don't remember what the reasons were in the news, but the fact is the structure was there. And as long as this bubble has expanded, we now have structure. And so, no, I would say it's because of the structure, and there's always that cover story. Yeah. You know, it's just the way it is. I remember the first time I remember something like that was with Chernobyl. I remember getting in, you know, involved in technical analysis and looking at charts, and back then soybeans was a big deal, and I remember it setting up and seeing it bottom, and then the Chernobyl thing happened and soybeans went up. So there's always that structure. Another one, I can't leave this one out. You know, I know, I mean, it's 100% statistic that when there's a certain cycle in the CRB index, that when it peaks with that left translated structure, it moves below its previous low. And that had happened on the CRB, and then you look at the relationship with oil. Well, I knew, and I've been saying in the letter, it's in the letter over and over and over, and I had to take it on the chin from people who didn't believe it until it came to pass, pounding that oil and commodities should go lower because of this statistic and the action on the CRB and some of the other commodity-related indexes. Well, look at oil. And,
yeah,
you know,
this was an amazing day in oil today. Oh,
right.
My goodness.
Right. So people say, well, it's because of the OPEC meeting. Well, was it? Or is it because of the statistic that's 100% accurate? You know,
yeah.
I don't know. So that would be my answer. It's you have to have the structure. And we have it now. I'm like you, though. You know, I don't know. I guess from the bubble perspective, I mean, I don't want to be too bearish, but it sure seems like it would be hard to recover from this, knowing the environment that we were in and seeing, seeing all of the monetary policy and the things that had happened to create the bubble. How is it not the end of that?
Yeah. I mean, that's an excellent point. And if you, when we look back at this time years from now, and people maybe do a little more studying in terms of valuation and how it affects markets. And I think, see, at a time like this, psychologically, no one's concerned with valuation. What are you guys talking about, valuation? The P.E. ratio on General Motors is only 6-1. And, you know, they give you all this stuff about stupid things about valuation and they have no realization about the long-term trends of valuation and what they mean and what you should actually look at. I mean, Edson Gould, who was, for my money, one of the greatest market masters of the past, he set up a rule during his time. I think he passed away maybe 20 years ago, 25 maybe. But his big rule was to look at dividend yield. And every time the market got as low as a dividend yield of 3, that was a great time, was a great valuation for the market. This is, you know, the large market averages, S&P 500, Dow Industrials. If they showed a dividend yield of 3%, they were good buys. And if they went down to 2%, I mean, that was almost a mortgage, your wife, children at home time, if the dividend yield got down to 2%. Well, guess what, Tim? The dividend yield's been around 2% for 20 years now. I mean, yes, the decline we had into the low in 09 brought it up to, I don't know, maybe 3, 3.5. But we've had this extremely and extraordinary dividend yield of 2% and lower on the market indexes that Edson Gould swore 25, 30 years ago through his career of several decades that would be an excellent place for you to buy the market. To sell the market. You know, those readings are below 2%. I think I saw it explained in a graphic that showed that if when the dividend yield gets below 2%, the average return over the next 10 years is around 1. It ranges from a plus 2% to a minus 2% annualized. That's over the next 10 years. Then that's when the dividend yield gets down to 2% or below. But we've been 2% or below for, gosh, you know, as I said, 10 or 20 years now, leaning on that number. So there's been this extraordinary period of overvaluation that most people, I mean, imagine young guys that were born in 1985, 1995, that are just entering the business now, and what they might think about valuation when you talk to them about, you know, the market being overvalued. It's just a completely different school that they're coming from. And, you know, maybe we're wrong, Tim. Maybe things have changed. Maybe this time around we're going to see something very different happen in the market. But I don't think that's the case at all. I don't think we're going to see anything like that at all. I think that history is going to win out again, as it always has in the past. And I think looking back at this time period, we'll say, oh my goodness, was that incredible how people thought that, which was easily the most overvalued market in history, and people thought that after the first 10 or 15% down, I mean, that's, this guy says it's a generational buying opportunity? What generation? Was he born? Well, I mean, that's incredible.
Let me add some fundamental stuff for why I think there's a good chance that the bubble has bursted, and besides just the structure. I mean, let me say this, and then I want to read through this list of stuff. The structure, until it is proven that it's mended itself, then as of, you know, it's broken. It's broken until it's not. So I'm operating under that the assumption, exactly.
Yeah.
But within that assumption, what we have seen going up into this bubble top is the following. When I say that this is the weakest recovery since the Great Depression, you know, we heard all the touting of the jobs numbers and all the stuff, and, you know, without getting into the political stuff, but, you know, let me just stop right there and read the facts. The employment growth rate began contracting in February 2015. That's a fact. So if it's contracting, it's not growing. All right? The GDP growth rate began contracting second quarter 2018. The CPI growth rate began contracting September 2011. The ISM Manufacturers Index, it was at the, now we had a pop, I think it was in February, and it's turned back down from what I remember. I can't remember the number for, well, actually that was in January, I guess we saw the pop, but it was at the lowest level since 2009. The ISM employment data, it was also, the growth rate was also contracting. Consumer credit peaked in November 2011. Domestic output of automobiles peaked in January 2013. Industrial production index peaked in August 2010, and the growth rate had actually gone below zero. Total vehicle sales peaked August 2015. The velocity of money had turned back down. The collapse of interest rates. I saw a statistic, the boxcar traffic, it only went back for 20 years, but it was at the lowest level in 20 years. So my point is, one of the things I've said all along is that this stock market bubble was a bubble, and that it was camouflage for the underlying economic, you know, true economic conditions. And so if the economy really is, and I'm not suggesting that it's not, I mean, it is, I believe these numbers because they're hard numbers, they're good numbers. But if these fundamental facts are what they are, then how are we going to how are you going to reinflate from here? So when I think about it that way, how is it not a major top?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
And you know, that fundamental stuff is not something that I normally look at, and I know it's not something that you look at, but it was an attempt to put it in perspective, you know. It wasn't like, you know, at least with the dot-com bubble, there was an economy driving that. You know, the cellular world was just coming online, and, you know, the information age and the internet, and, you know, there was something there of substance there. Here it's been monetary policy.
Yep.
So anyway, well, Peter, anything else you want to add? I mean, do you have, you know, any short, intermediate, long-term thoughts you want to add in closing?
You know, I always rely on my projections, Tim, and if I may brag for a second, they've been pretty spectacular lately. I'm sure a part of it was luck, but I actually went short with a mutual fund group that I manage, and we have had a tendency over the years to use 2x leverage. So in other words, if we go long, if the S&P goes up 1%, our fund goes up 2. If we go short, the S&P goes down 1%, we go up 2. But I took a short position, a 2x leveraged short position, in the S&P mutual fund at RightX Guggenheim on February 19th of 2020.
Wow.
At the exact all-time closing high. And people say, yeah, but when did you get out? Well, I actually got out on February 28th, which was the initial closing low that we just spoke about. get out of a half position earlier than that, but get out of the final position at virtually the exact short-term low on February 28th. Now, did I do that because I was brilliant? No, I did that because this price projection, the thing that I'm working on, especially this software that I'm so excited about, Tim, it gave projections that you look at them and you say, okay, the things you have to work out in your brain are, is it short-term, intermediate-term, long-term? But it gives you the ability to make these spectacular market forecasts about tops and bottoms and turning points. So when we get this kind of decline, excuse me, I just wait for my projections. And I can tell you this, I'm not going to give you any specific numbers, but we, as of the close today, and this is after a huge, huge down day with the S&P cash down 226 points rounded off, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average down 2,014 points, we still have lower projections. So, and in the case of the Dow, fairly significantly lower. So that's the thing that I live and breathe by, is my projection work and the cycles, and that's how I believe the market works. And that's telling me we have lower to go. Now, if we go down to some of these projections, we're going to be down, like, probably 20-25%, and we'll hear people start to talk about, well, that's the definition of a bear market, anything over 20%. And so, what they will be looking for at that point is, where do we buy? Where do we get in? I mean, look at this. You know, people that have been waiting around saying, Apple is down. There's so many percent. I've been waiting to buy it for a long time. Isn't this a great time to buy it? And everyone thinks that any kind of 10 or 20% decline in the market presents a wonderful buying opportunity. Buy the dips. And I think perhaps this time around, they're going to learn a different lesson, Tim. So that's one of the things that I want to make people aware of, is we might not be in a buy-the-dip atmosphere for a long time.
Right. And if Peter, like I said, as long, I guess from my perspective, to add to that, as long as the structure's broken, it's broken. And if this is the unwinding of the bubble, I will say this, it's just beginning. If that's where we're at, that's the question. But if that's where we're at, then it's just beginning. So
I tend to agree.
Yep.
I tend to agree.
Well, Peter, if someone wants to get in touch with you, how would they do so?
Well, if they want my market opinion, you know, I've been doing a daily YouTube market opinion thing, a video virtually every trading day. I stopped doing them for about a week after I put out a report, in fairness to people that pay for the reports. But the YouTube videos have been absolutely free. So the way they can get to my YouTube channel is go to the URL, the address of youtube.com/C/channel/stockmarketcycles. So if they put that in the address, that they will get to my channel on YouTube and be able to see all the old videos. I would highly recommend looking back at some of them around the top to see how well the cycles, the short-term cycles, caught this market top and how it came about. And so that's probably the best way to get a hold of us. And once they watch that, and they can go to the stockmarketcycles.com website. And I would encourage them, in fact, to go to the website, because I probably won't be doing any videos over the next week or so, because, as I said, my latest report just came out. So they can get that report online in 1995. There's a very specific projection that was in there already. In fact, it was in there before today's huge decline. And they might find that interesting. And also a chart of the pattern that you and I spoke about, that long 87 plus or minus year pattern that began way back in the mid-1800s, Tim. So there's a lot to look at there, a lot to chew on. That's probably the best way to contact the stuff that I work with.
Okay. And anyone listening to this somewhere else besides my website, let me add something on the letter. You know, back in, like I said, I saw the setup with the cycle, or the potential with the forcing of that low back in August for this to materialize. And then blow by blow, you know, in the January letter, I said, look, if this happens, then you know this could be a major top. And then in the February letter, I followed up because it was developing. And then in the short-term updates, you know, we watched it real time develop as the structure fell in place. It's just amazing. And as brutal as the process has been, you know, it would have been bad not to have seen that develop, but we did.
Yep.
And now here we are, and the structure, you know, it was key in identifying the top, and it's going to be key in identifying if we remain broke or if this is going to be a buy the dip thing. And that's where we are, and anybody can get in touch with me or the letter through the website, cyclesman.com. Peter, maybe we can do this again soon, or you know, whenever there's some new developments or new projections, or you know, you know, whatever the case may be. But I appreciate you coming on. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to have you. An honor to have you.
Always fun to talk with you, Tim. As I said earlier, nice to talk with a person knowledgeable about market history and whose work has shown that in the past. So it's fun talking together.
Thank you, Peter.